The following audio is from the weekly message at Summit Church in the upstate of South Carolina. More information is available at summitupstate.org.
Good morning. You can be seated. My name is Brian. I am part of the teaching team here at Summit. Sue and I make our home at Summit Simpsonville. Glad to be with you this morning. Before I dive into the text for today, let me just offer a pastoral encouragement to you. I don't know all of you. I know some of you. I anticipate that y'all have needs. I mean, I'm not a prophet, but I would think that many of you have, in fact, needs that are greater than you can meet yourself. And so when there are opportunities to pray for one another, I'm going to suggest you take advantage of that. I mean, part of the reason why we're here is to hear from Jesus. Part of the reason why we're here is to experience Jesus' presence in our midst. And part of the way that Jesus intends to make his presence known is through one another. And so, if I were to invite you and to say, if any of you have financial needs, there's $1,000 checks up here made out to whosoever will. I think I'd see people come up and pick up a check. And so when we say, Jesus would like to meet needs today and we'd like to pray for one another, I would just say, take advantage of that. We're called in Scripture to bear one another's burdens, to pray for one another, to care for one another. And maybe it's not been your church experience that you step forward or step out or people pray for you. I don't think in Jesus' day that was the way that people thought, but when they saw what Jesus could do, then they flocked to him and brought their needs. And you know what happened? Needs were met. Same Jesus, same ministry, same thing. He just wants to do it through us. So, just a little aside. If someone says, hey, would you like a $1,000 check to help pay your bills? You might say yes. If someone says, hey, would you like someone to pray with you that Jesus might meet needs in your life? And you all say, nah, I'm good. That just surprises me. Just a little encouragement. Next time someone says, maybe if you have a need, we can pray. I'll encourage you to say, yeah, I think I could avail myself of that, and we'll see what Jesus could do. Okay, so, well, if you could live yesterday over, you know, have the chance to do it over again, would you do anything differently if you look back on your day? Or how about if you could live last week over, or a month over, or a year over, would you think back over that and go, yeah, you know what, I could have lived a little differently, I could have acted a little differently, would you make other choices? I think most of us would. I think most of us looking back would say, I could have had a better day, I could have had a better month, I could have lived more significantly. Because the fact is, I think that all of us want our lives, our days, to be spent significantly. Right? You don't want to come to the end of the day or the week or a month at the end of your journey on the planet and have on your tombstone it just say, eh. You know, we want significance. We want our lives to matter. We want something. We want some appropriate greatness. And I know it's weird to talk about the greatness in the church. Isn't Jesus supposed to be great? Well, here's the thing you got to understand. You're in good company. Jesus' disciples longed for greatness. They wanted significance. They wanted their lives to matter. And here's the really remarkable thing. Jesus didn't rebuke them. When they longed for significance, when they longed for greatness, when they longed for lives that mattered in the kingdom, he didn't in fact rebuke them. He encouraged them. Yeah. Come on, you can have significance. You can have greatness. Your lives can matter in the kingdom. That's what we're going to talk about this morning. We're continuing in the Gospel of Mark. Why? Simply because life with Jesus is in fact where life is found. A relationship with him is in fact the thing that makes life worth living. And it's the Jesus we meet in the Gospels, not the Jesus of your own imagining, but the Jesus that we meet in the pages of this book. This is the Jesus who gives us life, and so we're learning from him and from his followers. We're going to be in Mark chapter 10 this morning, picking up some more of what Mark has to tell us about this Jesus and what it means to follow him. And so if you would open up your copy of the scriptures, you're going to read along with me. We're in Mark chapter 10. Why do I encourage you to open the book and read with me? These words matter. My words don't, ultimately. Dusty's words don't, ultimately. Terry's words don't, ultimately. All of our words might return void. These words don't. These words are backed up by the Spirit of God. These words are the words that change lives. That's why we spend time in this book. Not a thousand other books, this book when we gather. So it's a good habit, a really healthy habit to bring a copy of the scriptures so you become familiar with this book and these words. Mark chapter 10 is where we are. I'm going to start in verse 32. And they were on the road. Jesus and his followers. They were on the road going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was walking ahead of them, and they were amazed. And those who followed were afraid. And taking the 12 again, he began to tell them what was to happen to him, saying, "See, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him over to the Gentiles. And they will mock him and spit on him and flog him and kill him. And after 3 days he will rise." And James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came up to him and said to him, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you." And he said to them, "What do you want me to do for you?" And they said to him, "Grant us to sit one at your right hand and one at your left in your glory." And Jesus said to them, "You do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink, or to be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized?" And they said to him, "We are able." And Jesus said to them, "The cup that I drink, you will drink, and with the baptism with which I am baptized, you will be baptized. But to sit at my right hand or at my left is not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared." And when the 10, the other disciples, heard it, they began to be indignant with James and John. And Jesus called them to himself and said to them, "You know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them, but it shall not be so among you. But whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man has come not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." So Jesus is on his way to Jerusalem. He's already told them in previous chapters that that's where he's going, and has spoken some about what's going to happen there. And it says that as they're going, some were amazed. It's an interesting thing to say. That's the same kind of reaction that people had when Jesus told the young rich ruler how hard it was to enter into the kingdom. Amazement. Wow, that's a shocking thing. So some who are traveling with Jesus are shocked that he's going to Jerusalem, and it says that some are fearful. That's a word that's used when Jesus casts the demon out of the legion. I mean, the legion out of the guy, and the people saw the display of power, and it really scared them. This guy has great power. So some are surprised by Jesus going to Jerusalem. Some are fearful. Why might that be? Well, he's already told them, "I'm going to Jerusalem and I'm going to die. I'm going to Jerusalem. They're going to poorly treat me there." And they see Jesus making his way to Jerusalem, and the crowd has got a mixed response. Some of them are like, "Well, you're still going?" And some are going, "And you are going?" So some are surprised. Some are fearful. They couldn't make sense of why Jesus is continuing to go towards Jerusalem, having already told them, "When I arrive, they're going to kill me. I'm going to die." He, in fact, explains it again here in this text, what's going to happen when he gets there. They're going to condemn him to death, deliver him over to the Gentiles. They're going to mock him and spit on him and flog him and kill him. He's already said that's going to happen. Now here he says it again. This is the third time he's explaining what's going to happen when he gets to Jerusalem. More details here. More about, it's not just he's going to die, he's going to die a horrible death. It's not just a horrible death, but he's going to be scorned and mocked. What is going on with Jesus? Why is he still going there? That's why they're fearful. That's why they're amazed. You're still going there knowing what's going to happen. You need to feel that as they're on the way to Jerusalem and the disciples are going with him. And then James and John ask this really intriguing question. Some of the disciples are asking a question. They come up and say, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you." Does that not strike you as a puzzling kind of question to ask? Sadly, some commentators, please don't read commentators. Some commentators say, "Oh, James and John are just not tracking with Jesus. They're just really selfish. They're really self-focused. They're consumed about..." I don't think so. Because the previous time when Jesus spoke about his coming death, he then followed it up by talking about when he came in glory. Maybe James and John are the two that are actually paying attention to what Jesus is saying. Will your death, as tragic as that is, result in glory? They're tracking with him. That's what he had said previously. His death is going to be followed up with a display of his glory. So maybe James and John are puzzled about why he's going, but nevertheless, maybe they're picking up on what he's been saying. Jesus spoke of his death in chapter 8, but then he mentioned his coming in glory. Perhaps the disciples are a bit puzzled as to why he's going, but I think, trying to put the pieces together, I think James and John are going, and so there is glory coming, right? So James and John have a request. Well, we know that the bad stuff is coming, but then the glory is coming. Can we have the left and right hand? But did you notice how they start their request? "Jesus, we'd like you to give us whatever we ask of you. Do you have a relationship with anyone that you would do that with? Like you go to your boss and you go, 'Hey, boss, I've been working here for 5 or 6 years. I'd like you to do for me whatever I ask of you.' How would that go over? Hey, kids, how about asking your mom and dad that? 'Mom, dad, the weekend's coming. I'd like for you to do whatever I ask of you.'" What does that tell you about what James and John think about Jesus? There's very few people that I would do that with, and yet James and John seem to be really comfortable coming to Jesus and saying, "We'd like you to do whatever we ask of you." That tells me something about how they think about Jesus. They must think that Jesus, in fact, is glad to do stuff for others. Otherwise, you wouldn't ask that question. They're not terrified and troubled by coming to him with that question. And so Jesus doesn't blow them off and go, "How arrogant of you to think that I'm just going to do for it." No. In fact, Jesus says one of the things that he's most fond of saying, "What would you like me to do for you?" You read through the Gospels and you'll see that Jesus often says that kind of thing. "What would you like me to do for you?" They say, "Would you do for us whatever we ask of you?" And he says, "What would you want me to do for you?" Jesus' initial reply is, I'm glad to do something for you. What is it that you'd like?" So then they ask, and what are they asking for? Right hand, left hand seats in glory. They're asking, friends, they're asking for significance. As the kingdom goes forward and as your glory is seen, can we have a significant part in that? And Jesus' response is really startling. He doesn't say, "You wicked disciples wanting significance. You selfish followers thinking that you can get glory for your..." He doesn't respond that way. He doesn't respond that way. Jesus doesn't rebuke them. Jesus simply explains, "But it's not for me to give. I can't give that. It's been prepared for somebody." And Jesus doesn't explain any more than that. But it's really sweet to notice in their longing for significance, in their longing for greatness, Jesus neither rebukes them nor blows them off. He simply says, well, I can't give that. They are longing for lives of significance, lives that matter. They want recognition in the kingdom. "I don't want to spend my life with you, Jesus, and it be meaningless." And Jesus apparently doesn't see that to be a problem, that they long for that, as long as they pursue greatness the right way. And that's what he goes on to explain. Again, notice chapter 10, starting in verse 42. The other disciples hear about it. I don't know how you think about that. I kind of use my sanctified imagination. When James and John have come and said, can we have the prominent places in glory when you come? And Jesus doesn't rebuke them. I think the 10 went, oh, snap, I should have asked that. I didn't think to. They beat us to it. But Jesus calls them all together and is now going to explain what significance and greatness looks like. Chapter 42, you know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. But it shall not be so among you. But whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. He says, y'all know this. Everyone knows this. You all know that the rulers, that is, those who have a place of priority, and the great men, those who are really impressive and have prestige, they have a certain way of living. Jesus is speaking to his disciples. He goes, you know, in the world around you, those who have prominence and significance, they have a certain way of living. Those first ones live out their lives fundamentally on two grounds, he says. They either lord it over, or they exercise authority over others. Lord it over, that's a really uncommon expression. It's found only a few times in the New Testament, two times in the parallel of this passage. Nothing magical about that. A concordance helps you find out where these words appear and where they're found and what they mean. Acts chapter 19, verse 16 is one of the places where this expression, lord it over, appears. It's when seven sons of Sceva, seven sons of a Jewish exorcist, are trying to cast out a demon, and they're not very successful. They say, in the name of Jesus, whom Paul preaches, leave. And the demonized guy goes, Jesus, I know Paul, I know I don't know you. And it says that the demonized man fell on and lorded it over the seven sons of Sceva, and they fled out of the house naked and afraid. This expression of lorded over means using your power to get your way. Jesus goes, you know, prominence and significance in the world is done either by power, or then he says, lorded over or exercise authority. That's the idea of using your right to get things done. The first is using your might to get your significance. The other is using your right to get your significance. Jesus says, that's how it's done outside my kingdom. You want significance, it's either going to be right or might, power or authority. That's how you're going to get your significance. But then he says, it's not going to be that way here. Clearly, nearly everything, and clearly all those who lead or who have a place of priority or carry on life in the world, the basis of their significance is what they can make happen by their right or their power. But Jesus says, but it's not that way among you. ESV renders it shall not be that way among you. NAS actually, I think, renders it a little better. It is not that way among you, because they're already part of this kingdom. He goes, that's, you're living in this, guys. That's not how it's happening here. It's not by power. It's not by might. They've already been brought into this new kind of life as followers of Jesus, and this is not the life that Jesus is sharing with them. So Jesus explains. If significance is not going to come because I exercise my power to get what I want and have life on my terms, or my right to get life on my terms and get my significance by power or might, how is it going to be done? Look what he says. Whoever would be great among you. You want significance? You want greatness? You can have it. Whoever, notice he says, whoever wants to be great. I guess it's possible. Whoever wants to be great among you must be your servant. Whoever would be first among you must be the slave of all. Jesus is not dismissing the longing for greatness, the longing for significance. He's not dismissing the longing to have prominence and significance in the kingdom. Anybody could have prominence. Anyone could have significance. Anyone could have a first place in the kingdom. He's just clarifying there's a wrong way to pursue it and there's a right way to pursue it. Whoever wishes a life of significance in the kingdom can have it. Whoever wishes to have a life of significance in the kingdom can have it. You just have to pursue it. You have to run the race the right way. You have to run for last rather than run for first. You have to pursue that. That's what Jesus explains. He says, if you want to be great in the kingdom, then you need, anyone wants to be great in the kingdom, they need to become the servant. Among the followers of Jesus, the place of greatness belongs to the one who serves, the one who ministers to the needs of others, who looks out for the needs of others. If you're looking for a first place kind of finality in the kingdom, you need to be the slave of all. Among the followers of Jesus, firstness in kingdom comes from being a slave. That is, someone who's at the disposal of others. Now notice what Jesus doesn't say. He doesn't say, if you want a significance in the kingdom, you want a life that matters, serve people from time to time. Do serving kind of things. He doesn't use that language. He says you have to be a servant, be a slave. It's the kind of life you have, not the thing you do. Because it's possible to do servant things and not really be a, you know, there's a way that that becomes very evident. If you serve in any capacity, in the church, outside the church, in your family, in your work, if you serve, and then you feel a little tweaked because you go, hey, they just treated me like a servant. I kind of go, well, what did you want? Because, I mean, if you really were a servant and not simply doing servant things, then when they treated you like a servant, you'd go, yeah, that's what I wanted. I wanted to be a servant, and I was a good servant. Think about it this way. A good waiter, right? You go to a restaurant, a good waiter, a good waitress. What are you hoping that the good waiter or the good waitress will do? Pull a chair up, sit down, have a conversation with you, ask you how impressed you are with what they're doing for you. What do you want for a good waiter or a good waitress? Bring the food, leave it, and just do what waiters and waitresses do.
Silent refills and free busing.
Yeah. You want the waiter or the waitress to serve. Without expectation of a polite golf applause, right, at the end. And if the waiter or the waitress is a servant, if someone is truly a servant, then what do? They just serve. And if they're treated like a servant and what they really want is to be a servant, then they got what they want. And Jesus goes, that's where the significance in the kingdom comes. Not do servant-like things from time to time for others. This is a call to an attitude of heart, a disposition of life. It's understanding kingdom life as that of a servant life or slave life. Here's the reason why. Notice what Jesus says. For even the Son of Man has come not to be served, but to serve. When Jesus thinks about himself, he walks into a scene. How is he thinking about himself? I'm a servant. That's why I'm here. The Son of Man has come not to be served, but to serve. So when Jesus steps into a scene, he's there to serve because that's how he sees himself. He sees himself fundamentally as the Father's sent servant. Friends, why did he die for you? To serve you. He gives his life as a ransom, as a servant. So if you're going to share in Jesus' life, candidly, Jesus doesn't have boss life to share with you. He doesn't have demanding supervisor life to share with you. The only kind of life Jesus has to share with us is servant life. That's his life. For the Son of Man has come not to be served, but to serve and give his life in ransom for many. So you participate with him. Where will you find yourself? Wherever Jesus is. And what will you find Jesus doing? Serving. So you want to be significant and have greatness in his kingdom? Then just join him in the kind of life that he has. If you want to get on his right-hand side and then his left-hand side, you'll find him serving. So if, in fact, you want prominence and significance in the kingdom, then there's only one place to find it, with him as a servant. Read the Gospels. Everywhere Jesus goes, he's meeting needs. Everywhere Jesus goes, he's serving others. Jesus lives this way. And apparently it's reflected in the disciples' question when they said, we'd like you to do for us whatever we ask. Why would you ask that? Because they think he's a servant. They respond to him that way. Those in Jesus' kingdom know that their lives are defined by him, not by their power, not by their authority, but by him. So they live that way. So when Jesus says the Son of Man has come not to be served, but to serve and give his life a ransom for many, did you notice in verse 32 and 33 how he talked about himself? The Son of Man will be delivered over. They will condemn him. They will deliver him over to the Gentiles. They will mock him. They will spit on him. They will flog him. They will kill him. And all of that is to serve you and to serve me. They're going to do it to him. He's not exercising power. He's not exercising his authority for his greatness. He is coming like a servant, and he gets treated like one. And so he calls all who wish to follow him to think and live the same way. I would say that followership, discipleship, significance, a life that matters is available to all of you. Jesus goes, whoever wants this, you can have this kind of life. But it is only your significance, your value, the greatness your soul longs for is only going to be experienced by those who lean into the kind of life Jesus invites you into. You won't find significance and greatness any other way. Discipleship, followership looks like being a servant and slave of all, because there it is that you share in Jesus' life. I think many Christians don't experience significant life, joyful life, kingdom life, because we don't really believe what Jesus is saying here about significance is found in servanthood. And I know this because I hear comments that people make, things like, you don't want me to just serve like everyone, that person? You expect me to serve someone like that? Yeah, servant of most. Servant of some. Servant of those who reciprocate well. No, servant of all. What's your disposition? Do you see yourself as sharing in Jesus' life, who has come to be the servant of all? And then if you raise the question, you can't expect me to serve that kind of person, can you? And I would say that only indicates you don't think that Jesus got it right. He misstated when he said servant of all and slave of all. He meant servant of some. Servant of those who meet your criteria, of those that you'd like to serve. And then some people go, well, if you call me to be servant of all, slave of all, that's not fair. Welcome to the gospel, friends. The gospel is not fair. You're not getting from Jesus what you deserved. Because if you got from Jesus what you deserved, then this place would be empty. Do you understand what I'm saying? You're getting from Jesus what you don't deserve because he served you and he laid down his life as a ransom for you, not because you deserved it. If you say this isn't fair, this kind of life isn't fair, it only means you're thinking that following Jesus is about getting something out of the life of others. What are they going to return to me? Wait, do you not understand? Jesus has already given you life. Jesus has already laid down his life for you. He's already been the supreme servant to you. And you go, what am I going to get out of serving? Oh, just life with Jesus. That's all. Is that enough? That's more than fair, let me tell you. That is gloriously good and gracious. Some people go, well, when will I be on the receiving end of being served? That only betrays that you don't think that you're genuinely being served by the chief servant, Jesus. You think somebody else is going to have to add to what Jesus does for you before you feel like you're getting as good as you give. The fact is, you've already received better than you'll ever give. You're already on the receiving end of the greatest serving that you could expect. Some people then ask this question. They go, does this mean I have to do whatever someone asks me to do? I'm going to suggest that's asking the wrong question. If your first thought is, do I have to do whatever somebody asks me to do? If my first thought isn't, how can I serve? My first thought is, do I have to do whatever they ask me to do? Then I think you've misunderstood. It's not a call to do serving things. It's a call to be a servant. That is your identity. That is who you are, because you share in Jesus' life, and that's his identity. That's who he is. So if your first thought is, if your first thought isn't, what can I do for you? Then you haven't started to see yourself as sharing in Jesus' life, and you will miss what it means to live significant in the kingdom. Now, I will say, in answer to this question that sometimes people ask, does this mean I have to do whatever someone else asks me to do? The tendency to ask that question is because I want to define my servanthood in select categories. The right thing to do in the midst of a need is to ask the question Jesus asked, what do you want me to do for you? But does this mean that you will always do whatever somebody asks of you? I would say no. No. But that can't be the first question. You got to get deeper than that. There will be times when someone asks you to do something and you will say no. How do I know that's the case? Jesus does it. There's a time when the Pharisees come to Jesus and say, hey, we just want you to give us a sign from heaven. If you do that, we'll lodge you. Jesus goes, I'm not giving you any sign. And you might read that and go, wait, how come Jesus isn't serving them? Well, because their request is not a serious request about a need. Their request is manipulative. A true servant isn't manipulated, because the person who's manipulated is hoping by giving into the request, I get credit, I get affirmation. That's not a true servant's heart. So when the Pharisees go, hey, jump through this hoop and we will lodge you, Jesus goes, servants don't do that, because I'm not looking for anything from you. I'm just here to serve when there are legitimate needs. So sometimes you can say no to a request. If you really loved me, you'd do this. You hear that request, immediately you know that's manipulative. That is. And Jesus says no to those kinds of requests. Now, there's another time when you might say no to a request, and that is where there are multiple opportunities to serve, and you opt for one opportunity over another, and you'll have to say no to one in order to say yes to the other. Jesus does this in the Gospel of Mark, chapter 1, where Jesus has been healing people all night outside of Simon's mother-in-law's house. Early the next morning, he arose and departed and went out to a lonely place and was there praying. And Peter and his companions found him, and they said, everyone is looking for you. There's more people to be healed. And Jesus said, let's go somewhere else so that I might preach the gospel there also, for that's what I came out to do. So he leaves one serving in order to serve in another way. So there might be times when you will say no to an opportunity to serve. But we tend not to say no to an opportunity to serve because there's a greater opportunity to serve. We tend to say no to an opportunity to serve because I don't want to do that. It's not what Jesus does. It's not that I don't want to do that. It's because there's this other need that I have to be attentive to. So yes, there might be times when you'll say no to something if it's manipulative or if it's in fact part of a competing need to serve. But here's the big idea. There is a call to greatness. There is a call to significance, and it's by sharing in Jesus' life. And it is to see yourself as becoming his follower and joining him in his life, then you see your life the way he sees his life, and that means you see yourself as a servant. You walk into any situation. If Jesus, and he's here, present this morning, that's the reason why we encourage you to pray for one another. If Jesus walks into this place on a Sunday morning, do you know what he would be doing? Going among us, looking for needs that needed to be addressed, that he would address in the power of the Spirit for the glory of the Father. He would be serving, and since he's the greatest in the kingdom, he would be serving all of us. And then he extends his arms and says, hey, if you want greatness in the kingdom, just join me there. Join me there. You can be great. Share in his glory. Participate in his kingdom. You just don't get it on your terms. You just get it on Jesus' terms. Now, this account that we just read closes with an interesting little picture. I'm picking up in chapter 10. I'm going to read verses 46 through 52. There, they come to Jericho, which is on the way to Jerusalem. And as he was leaving Jericho with his disciples and a great crowd, Bartimaeus, a blind beggar, the son of Timaeus, was sitting on the roadside, and when he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to cry out and say, Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me. And many rebuked him, telling him to be silent. But he cried out all the more, son of David, have mercy on me. And Jesus stopped and said, call him. And they called the blind man, saying to him, take heart, get up, he's calling you. And throwing off his cloak, he sprang up and came to Jesus, and Jesus said to him, Notice, Jesus says the same thing to him that he says to James and John. What do you want me to do for you? It's one of Jesus' favorite things to say. And the blind man said to him, Rabbi, let me recover my sight. And Jesus said to him, go your way. Your faith has made you well. And immediately he recovered his sight and followed Jesus on the way. Now, this is not an allegory. This is actually a healing account. It did actually happen this way. It's not merely an illustrative story. But I do think there's something to take note here. Barnabas makes a request of Jesus. I want something from you. And Jesus' reply is very similar. What do you want me to do for you? Now, when James and John ask for seats, Jesus says, I can't give that. But you know what? He doesn't have that problem with Bartimaeus. I can do that. I'm here to serve. I can do that for you, Bartimaeus. And he clarified one thing he could do, one thing he couldn't, and he did the thing he could as a servant. Bartimaeus had a real physical need, and Jesus resolved it. And what was Bartimaeus' response to having experienced the grace of Jesus? It's not an allegory, but it's a really sweet follow-up to what it means to be a disciple. Notice what happens. He calls out to Jesus for mercy. He runs to Jesus and actually lays his cloak aside. That's a big risky thing for a blind guy. That's the thing he sleeps in. That's the thing he keeps warm. He throws it aside and runs to Jesus and then cries out, falls down before Jesus, and makes his need known. Jesus then changes him in a moment, and he follows Jesus. That is a great picture. Would you long for mercy from Jesus? Many of you have experienced it. You've cried out to him. And he's asked you, what do you want me to do for you? And you say, I'd like life in place of death. I'd like holiness in place of sin. I'd like an eternity with you rather than an eternity separate from you. And he goes, of course. And he gives you life. When Bartimaeus experiences that, what does he do? He goes, I'm with you then. And he follows. What about you? Have you heard Jesus' call? Have you presented your needs to him? Have you heard his healing words? Do you want his kind of life? Have you heard the invitation this morning to join him as a servant? Will you drop everything and follow him like Bartimaeus did? That's the invitation. You can have greatness. You can have this life. Now here, I'm going to say something that's not going to sound pastoral. I've been in church for decades. Hear this. The church does not need you to serve. Church does not need you to serve. The kingdom is not advancing because we're helping Jesus out. Jesus is not looking for worker bees in order to make his things happen, because Jesus says the Son of Man has come not to be served. So there is a right way to think about our participation with Jesus. There's a wrong way to think about participation with Jesus. The wrong way to think is, friends, if you don't man up and do what needs to be done, the church is going to... What? The church is going to survive. Jesus is sovereign, powerful over the life of the church. I don't want you to be guilted into serving. I want you to be encouraged into serving, because you can share in the glory of the kingdom by participating with Jesus in his kind of life. The reason why the church extends an invitation to serve is not because we need it, but because you could be great. Do you understand? Massively different. The disciples said, we want lives of significance. We want lives of significance with you, Jesus. We would like greatness in the kingdom. And Jesus says, anyone who wants that, come on. Join me. For the joy, the satisfaction, the amazing delight of greatness in the kingdom. By, in a sense, simply seeing yourself the way Jesus sees himself. Join me in a life of not doing serving things, not plugging holes. Being a participant in Jesus' life. Being a servant. Let's pray. just, when I watch you, Jesus, in the Gospels, and see what you do and the way you care, and as I experience that in my own life, I taste grace, I taste mercy, I feel your kindness, I experience new life. But like with the disciples, I want more. I don't want to just go through the motions. I don't want to just come on Sunday mornings and listen. I want to participate with you in a life that matters. I want holy, H-O-L-Y, I want holy and appropriate significance. And I am so encouraged this morning to hear your invitation to James and John and the 10, and to everyone who is seated here this morning at Easley. You want to be great? Come. Come on. You want significance? Come on. Don't settle for mediocrity. Don't settle for anything less than life with me. Therein we can find the abundant life our souls long for. Thank you for a free and open invitation to kingdom greatness as servants serving with you. Amen.
Thank you for joining for this week's message. Summit Upstate's mission is to give every man, woman, and child the repeated opportunities to see, hear, and respond to the gospel. We'd love to connect with you, so we invite you to reach out to us at summitupstate.org.